Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. My name is Ben Golliver, BlazersEdge.com. Joining me, as always, Kevin Pelton from Basketball Perspectives. Kevin, how does it feel to be a famous podcaster?
Well, it feels kind of weird because I don't know when the last time was we did a podcast.
I could look it up in iTunes, but I'm too lazy, but I think it's around 6 months ago. But that didn't stop us from earning. This is probably the greatest honor of our joint careers. Actually, there's no probably about it. It is the greatest honor. We were named as another one of Portland's podcasts you should listen to by Portland Mercury, which is actually a newspaper. Bobby Roberts and Allison Hazlett, hopefully I'm pronouncing those names right, they've got us in here along with pop culture geek podcasts, arts podcasts, comedy podcasts. We're in the sports category. We're in there with a Timbers podcast, something called Rip City Bad Boys. But here's how they describe us, Kevin. A long-running but sporadically updated podcast.
I think that's fair.
I think that's probably absolutely accurate. Thanks, guys. Nailed it.
It's an honor just to be nominated.
Yeah, it is an honor just to be nominated. Not only that, but they have a podcasting tip section. And we violate all of them. Number one, audio quality. Is there a worse audio quality podcast on the internet? No. So number one, we already didn't follow that. And also they say that there aren't enough women in podcasts. That was one of their conclusions, and we're failing that one too. So Portland Mercury, despite our horrible shortcomings, we appreciate the honor. And we dedicated this podcast just to you so that we can take a long, long, humble brag lap around the podcast.
I would describe us as the Kevin Martin shooting form of podcasts. We break all the rules, we're completely unorthodox, but somehow we're still effective.
Yeah, hopefully we don't end up on the injured list. Okay, now, let's get right to it. There's a lot going on kind of for a summer, well, at least in comparison to some recent years, comparison to last year when we were dealing with the lockout, we all thought we might die. So, just looking up. Let's start with Brandon Roy. Because that's all we ever really ever talk about. We only really get this podcast together for the big issues. You know, we hit the real big one.
The hard hitting.
You're a Brandon Roy homer, and your little story about Brandon for Blazers Edge, seeing him in that pro-am game, got a lot of views. People were talking about it. I had all sorts of people saying you should be writing the site because you're better than us. So, break it down. What was that experience like? And also, more from the standpoint of what you were expecting after 6 months of, you know, virtually nothing from him in public. And after the whole weirdness of the amnesty, the way the play staff laid out, just give us that first person approach.
Well, 15 months, I think it was more, it's more like 15, right?
Oh, if you want to say from, you know, last time he played basketball till not. I mean, he was still in the public consciousness, I think, when he came back in December. Because you remember back in December, there was a lot of excitement briefly that he was going to somehow be able to be productive, right? Like they mentioned, oh, maybe he could start. Nate came out and said, oh, we're going to try to give him big minutes and see if he can handle it. And I think that got people so upset, and it kind of like erased his slate a little bit. It was like, okay, lockout's over. Everybody's just going to kind of hope blindly. And then, you know, the last, you know, during the comeback, he was very quiet. I mean, he didn't do anything besides make a few comments from December until, you know, July. And all of a sudden, boom, here he is. Big press conference, David Kahn side by side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of slowly built. You know, the interesting thing is, I pointed out in that story, is last year we were told that he was going to play in the Jamal Crawford charity game that was held at Key Arena that we both attended, and then there was also word that he was going to play in the LaMarcus Aldridge charity game, and he ended up not showing, or he was there for the game at Key Arena, but in street clothes and did not play. So, you know, it was interesting. He talked afterwards about how it was the first time he had played a game with uniform and a clock and everything since his last game for the Blazers in the 2011 playoffs. So I felt kind of a unique privilege to have been at both that last game for Roy in Portland and then his first game since then here in Seattle. I mean, part of it was because of those experiences. I think people, after Will Conroy had started to hint on Twitter that Roy was going to be there and then eventually confirmed it, people were still skeptical, is he actually going to show up and play? Until he walked through the door, I wasn't totally convinced myself. So that's where, you know, just seeing it up, I think, was part of making this real.
Absolutely. So you look at, you know, how did he play? I mean, give us a breakdown. I know you wrote about it, but, I mean, you said he was, what, 80% in terms of, you know, how hard he was going, but did he look like B-Roy of old or at least some sort of an approximation?
I mean, there were moments of it. You know, it's really hard to tell at that level of play. He's not getting defended by Marcel Webster, who was on the other team. You know, they had kind of a defensive specialist, and I don't even know his background. I knew a few of the other players that were on the court there, but there's a pretty big gap in level of play between NBA stars and guys who, you know, played at the community college level or something like that around here. So that's one of the weird things about the Jabal Crawford Pro-Am League. First half, he was really kind of tentative, and I think he talked about this in his press conference today that you transcribed on Blazers Edge, that, you know, he was just kind of getting used to it. There was some fatigue there. But in the second half, he started getting to the basket a bit more and using the same kind of hesitation moves and things like that we saw from Brandon in his prime. So, you know, that those skills are still there. They haven't gone away.
So here's the big money question then. You love B-Roy, you know, you're a total B-Roy homer, you're a Seattle honk, you know, you want to build a stadium just for him to play by himself in, you don't even want an NBA team, you love Brandon, he's a UW, you're a UW, blah, blah, blah. Was there a moment where you felt like, I don't want Brandon to do this, I don't want him to get hurt, and it seems like he might get hurt if he keeps doing this? Did you have that thought in the back of your mind? Are you kind of wishing when you were watching him play, like, hey, maybe just go sit on the sideline and call it good?
I wouldn't say I had that thought at any point watching him. And, I mean, it didn't look like he was in pain or anything like that. So, you know, I don't think that's a real issue. Obviously, long term, nobody knows what continuing to play will do for his knees. I mean, we're not doctors. I think the one concern I had that I think that his decision to take a break, apparently not retire, and the dynasty, you know, I worried that it was going to end in Portland if Brandon's ego couldn't handle not being the guy if he wasn't capable of doing that physically. And I think that's still potentially an issue in Minnesota if he's going in, you know, and what, 35 minutes a game was thrown out in the podcast and in the press conference. I mean, that's a lot of minutes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, his interview was soft, and he was talking like he was Kobe Bryant, man. You know, he's got, I'm bringing my friend along with me. I'm, you know, ready to play at a high level. You know, he didn't want to say that he's ready to be a star, but he used that phrase high level in the press conference again. I mean, he's coming back full force. And so I guess my question with, you know, asking you if you had any hesitation when you watched him in Seattle was, how should NBA fans, not necessarily Blazers fans, but how should NBA fans approach his coming season? Should this be two arms wide open, or should there be like a little bit of a, you know, a fear almost of like, Is there going to be an inevitable health problem that's going to be so difficult to watch that we don't want to watch it, that people should maybe prepare themselves for mentally? Or are we still in a position where it's like, hey, it's a grace period, he's coming back, there shouldn't be massive expectations from the outside, he can set whatever expectations he wants, but at least he's back and we get to watch him play, one game is better than no games kind of thing?
I think I'm in the latter position. You know, it was just fun to watch Brandon play basketball. I mean, that's one of my favorite things to do, and I've gotten the opportunity to do it more than probably, you know, I ought to over the course of his time at UW and then the Blazers following them so much the last 4 years. But it's a privilege to watch him play. So any Brandon Roy we get is a good thing. You know, I don't think I'm not that worried. You know, there's a long-term effect, but, you know, you see that with guys like Kevin McHale and Phil Jackson. It's something that, you know, it takes its toll years down the line, and obviously no one wants that to happen for Brandon Roy, but I don't think it's like something that watching him play next season, like his knee is going to fall off or something. So I think that's a question mark. You know, if there's really a possibility that he's back more than average, he's the kind of player, or even he's the kind of player that he was at the end of 2010-11 for the Blazers and tarnish his legacy a little bit, I don't know, maybe.
Okay, so well, we got to talk about the amnesty thing because there's all these questions of, oh, you know, is this some conspiracy theory? You know, Brandon, he said one thing about how he was going to pursue medical retirement, then he was going to pursue, and then he said in the press conference it was never his idea to retire. He was getting advice. I mean, have you dug into the nitty-gritty of that, and do you have a position on that?
I don't have a position on that. I mean, there's definitely some weirdness there, and, you know, I think that the fact that the amnesty allowed the Blazers to sign Jamal Crawford, who's one of Brandon Roy's good friends, is clearly somehow a factor in this all. But, you know, I think that's probably something that we're not going to know the whole story on for some time down the road, if ever.
Yeah, well, here's kind of my take on it is this. Coming in December after the lockout, even at that press conference where they were announcing he was going to have all these minutes and everything else, that press conference was by far the weirdest one of all the other comments. I mean, you go back to Larry Miller's first statements where he just met the press by himself, and then some of the other things that unfolded over the course of that week, and all the rumors that had come out even in advance of training camp opening or the Blazers being able to communicate with fans. I mean, all signs pointed to the amnesty. You know, that was sort of like the end goal. So everything along, you know, that entire week, it was always sort of judged across, like, how does this get us closer to the amnesty? And a lot of the things along the way, you know, the discussion of the medical issues in the public that you don't normally hear about, you know, Brandon talking about how he wants to do what's good for his family. I mean, a lot of those things seemed to me very strategic in terms of setting up what was going to be a very difficult breakup. Because Brandon was so popular and he had, you know, been so good, you know, fairly recently. It just seemed to me like the way everything played out, it was only one way that was going to happen. They were never bringing Brandon back for the season, almost, you know, no matter what. So to me, you know, anything that he says, I don't necessarily hold against him during that week-long process because, you know, it was getting towards where they were going anyways. And clearly he was involved in that process with multiple discussions with Blazers management, with the coaching staff and everything else. You know, Brandon's a class guy. He's going to go along with whatever the plan is, and he's also going to do whatever is, you know, potentially in his best interest in terms of trying to make sure he doesn't get claimed off of amnesty. And so I think, you know, one of the other standout things from that whole time was, you know, him making it clear, oh, he was, you know, retired and he didn't want to be picked up and he was done for good. And to me, that didn't sound like Brandon Roy at all. That sounded like, you know, a tactic of, hey, I need some time to get my body right, but I don't want to get claimed by some team I don't want to play for and be on their books for multiple years. I want to have my freedom whenever I do decide to come back. And so it seemed like a little bit of a scare tactic, almost like what Chauncey Billups did after he left New York, but a stronger version of that. And I'm not sure anyone was necessarily going to claim him given how many years was left on his contract, but I think they were just trying to, you know, be careful to make sure he was an unrestricted free agent so he could double dip and all that. So to me, I don't hold anything against Brandon for comments he made in December. Ultimately, it was the organization's decision to amnesty him. They have to live with all the results of that. You know, Brandon couldn't have come back if he had wanted to. There wasn't really any method for him to be able to convince the team to spend that much money, go into luxury tax and pay him and all those other things. It wasn't a particularly good fit roster-wise in terms of how things were shaking out. How was he going to play with Raymond Felton trying to push the ball, and that's kind of the direction they were trying to go? How was it going to work ego-wise, like you mentioned before? I mean, there were open questions. And it didn't seem like such a great fit as it had, you know, maybe a year or two previously. So, I mean, I don't hold anything that Brandon said in that Minnesota press conference I thought was fair game. I don't think he crossed any lines. I don't think he really owed anybody anything at that point. And I think, you know, it's officially time to move forward and put all that other stuff behind it. You agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree. I think it worked out well the way it played out for everyone. I mean, I think the interesting thing from my standpoint is the fact that Brandon was away from the game of basketball for so long. Like, he wasn't out attending UW games or Blazers games until the end of the season. And I don't know if that's because of the fact that the game was temporarily taken away from him that year or because of the fact that he was struggling with the notion that the game might be taken away from him forever.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think he's definitely keeping a low profile. He wasn't making any, mistake about that. I mean, it's very, you know, very purposeful. But, you know, Brandon was always like that. You know, he was very rarely doing anything in the public eye whatsoever through his entire time in Portland. So to me, you know, having him, you know, disappear, it wasn't a huge surprise. And it was also, I mean, he was keeping everybody guessing. Like, when he showed up for that Blazers game for Jamal Crawford's birthday and sat courtside, I mean, it seemed like it was surprising to the team. They didn't really seem prepared for it. It wasn't like he had, scripted that comeback and the ovation that he got. I mean, it was sort of spontaneous, almost as if he had just sort of decided to do it. And so, I don't know. I mean, nothing really seemed out of character for him either way. I think, you know, if he had been, you know, quiet for 2-3 years, it wouldn't have surprised me because he's just he's not that kind of a guy who's, you know, off the court trying to get a lot of attention. You know, he's still not on Twitter. He's just the last person that. In America without a Twitter account.
Well, so what do you think the reaction is going to be like when he comes in for the first time to the Rose Garden as a member of the Minnesota Timberwolves on November 23rd?
Well, it better be a standing ovation. Anything else? I'm not trying to be in the tank for Roy, but come on, man. This guy was ridiculous. He single-handedly, I mean, we saw what happened with the Blazers in terms of leadership and direction and camaraderie when they didn't have him. They couldn't replace it last year. LaMarcus Aldridge was not the number one guy. He couldn't be. He doesn't have that personality. People didn't follow him. It blew up, And the fact that it blew up, you can't attribute that only to Brandon's absence. Of course, there was other variables, entering the equation, Felton, Crawford, everybody else. But this guy, he took him to the playoffs multiple times, three-time All-Star, Rookie of the Year, said everything right, until, a few ugly incidents at the very end, did everything he could in the community, local kid. I mean, all those things to me says you need to welcome him completely with open arms and realize that he's got to have a life too. There may be some people who, are bitter about how the whole thing played out, but if you have resentment, in this situation, it has to be towards the organization. There's the one who pulled the trigger on the amnesty, and there was reports and rumors weeks in advance of anything about his health coming back that they were going to do that anyway. And they already knew the status of his health going back years. So, to me, it was their decision. If he wants to come back, he's an old friend. He's someone you care about. You should try to support him doing whatever he's going to do.
All right, next question. Given that the Blazers have retired the jersey of almost everyone who's ever played for the team, I think, technically speaking, do you eventually get number 7 in the rafters?
Oh, I think that's a done deal. I mean, it's weird, though, because I guess the longer he plays, if he's able to have, a whole second act where he's playing, 4 or 5 years with another team, then it gets to be a little bit weird. But I thought, at the end of that day, no matter what, his jersey was going to be retired. It was done, and we did the jersey retirement formula on it, and he passed with flying colors because he started his career with the franchise, his best years with the franchise, he ended his career with the franchise, and now he's back, so he loses some points for that. He reached a very high level of play that very few players over the course of the franchise history have reached in terms of getting all NBA. I mean, there's not all that many Blazers who have hit that. In terms of his importance to the community, which is always really valued by the Blazers when they retire in jerseys, I mean, it seemed like a no-brainer. But it's weird. It's almost like the longer his career goes, the less certain it becomes that his jersey gets retired. Does that make sense? It's kind of a weird paradox.
It does. But, I got to say, no matter how well this comeback goes, it's hard for me to imagine ultimately thinking of Brandon Roy as anything but a Blazer.
Well, we'll see, man. I mean, he's still, he's 20. He just turned 28, right? So let's say best case scenario, he pulls one of these Tracy McGrady things, and then, people used to say Tracy McGrady was a member of the Orlando Magic, right? Now we just say he's, a member of the traveling commission because he's played for every single team or whatever. But if he plays another 4 or 5 years, let's say he does them in Minnesota, or if he bounces around, he does the whole veteran minimum route. I mean, he's going to be remembered in Portland for that era. But, already people are looking back at this era as one they want to forget mostly because of Odin and how he just contributed absolutely nothing and raised expectations so high and then failed to deliver on them. And Nate McMillan even barely didn't want to talk about it. It's like, okay, that's done. That was injuries. We're moving on going forward. So I'm not sure he gets to have that same great shine 15 years ago or 15 years from now, because, in hindsight, this isn't going to look as great as maybe it felt at its high point as it was unfolding, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that does make sense. I mean, I think ultimately with time, you start to forget about the bad parts and remember the good parts, and, I think that will definitely happen.
Here's the thing, Casey. They never won a playoff series, So what were the good parts? There was obviously some, huge shots that he made, the amazing comeback that we talked about earlier, and, we know the highs. But, if he goes on and has a 10-year career and all those other memories are part of the equation, and now, he split his loyalty between multiple franchises or he split his reputation between multiple franchises, I think it's going to dim it a little bit. It was almost the best-case scenario for his legend, I think, if he had just walked away completely. I think he would have gone down, just right below Walston and Drexler as, the greatest Blazer ever, and I think he can only come down from that loss. Does that make sense?
Well, especially because basically his last memory would be the game against Dallas, the fourth quarter. So it was almost, I mean, that wasn't the final thing, Gordon, if he's not back with the Wizards, but close to that.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's going out on top. It's like the Jordan shot over, over Russell or whatever. I mean, that would have been the moment. And then, yeah, so now, potentially, this becomes like a wizard scenario where everyone's just pretending that this whole thing doesn't happen. But if he succeeds, or if he even goes out and averages, say, 12, 13 points a game off the bench or whatever, all of a sudden, his story is totally different. And, I don't think anyone's ever going to forget him. I'm just worried that the legend is going to get a little bit of cracks in it the longer he continues to play. And I'm not saying he shouldn't do it. I'm just saying, hey, this is a fact of reality he has to deal with. But let's change this up totally, KP. Let's make this a little bit more light. Now that we're just trying to deconstruct legend, let's talk about Summer League, but let's not really talk about the players because I understand you didn't even really watch the games. Let's talk about an incident in which I almost killed you, not on purpose, and actually I blame you completely. But we have audio of me telling this story already on a show called Hoop Speak Live. It's run by Beckley Mason of True Hoop. They do a great job. Somehow they randomly asked me this story, and I went off on a tangent, and I started the story by saying I was going to completely sell you out, and then it goes up on YouTube, and so everybody can see it. So first of all, sorry for that. That's not a good way to start a story, is
it? No, that doesn't usually end well.
And so here's the story. It happened. Kevin came in for a weekend of Las Vegas Summer League, and disaster happened. Here's the story. Here's how I almost killed it.
It's actually a question from James Herbert, our producer, and I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. You will, so I'll just read it verbatim.
Sure.
One second. The staff chat just kicked me down. Okay. You could ask Ben how he almost killed Kevin Pelton and ended the Dontonio Wingcast forever.
Well, that's
Can you
true.
explain that? What does that mean?
No, that's absolutely true. It's Kevin. Kevin handled Vegas, the Summer League, worse than anyone's ever handled Vegas. And actually, I'm going to just totally sell him out right now on this show. And hopefully, we can upload this
Fire.
and email him. Okay, here's what happened. He shows up in Vegas. I've been in Vegas for 2.5 weeks, right? I was in Vegas for like a total of almost a month this summer doing USA Basketball and everything else. So Kevin parachutes in for a weekend, right? He's all excited. He's going to go to In-N-Out Burger 6 times in 3 days. He's got it all planned out, right? He's in Vegas for 7 hours and he freaking loses his cell phone. The all-time rookie mistake of rookie mistakes. Not only does he lose his cell phone, but he loses his cell phone in a cab. So I'm like, God, Kevin, what are you doing? It's like the stupidest thing. Like, are you a 14-year-old girl right now? Is this the first time you've been drunk? Now, I don't drink, so I'm just giving him a hard time about it, whatever. So Kevin also pulls a veteran maneuver, and this was like the Kurt Thomas, Juwan Howard move of knowing every trick in the book. Kevin calls up every Las Vegas cab company and literally tracked down a cell phone from the cab driver who had turned it in. And so then now I was in charge with the rental car of helping Kevin go pick up the cell phone, right? Well, obviously he didn't have a cell phone. This is actually kind of reminding me of the London Olympics opening ceremonies. Do you remember that thing where like the girl and the guy, that's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember how like they called the cell phone, but she didn't have it, but then somehow he was calling her. It didn't make any sense. Anyway, so I try to call him. I try to call him from his hotel to arrange the pickup so that we can go pick up his cell phone, right? Because he has to be there in person to do it. He's the only one who's going to hand it over to him. So Kevin's supposed to be standing outside this door in his hotel room, a door I previously dropped him off at. He's not there. So I'm sending him like angry, I'm stressed out because, I have all these deadlines and everything. Angry emails every 2 minutes. Kevin, you have 5 minutes to be here at this door. I'm going to leave you and screw you and your cell phone. You're never going to get it back. Like the next one was like increasingly angry. Like, I said 5 minutes. It's been 3. So that means you have 2 left. You better be down here. He's not down there, right? So finally, I give up on him and I don't want to be a bad friend, but I'm like, God, Kevin, you're not where you're supposed to be. I wanted to help you get your cell phone, but you're just going to have to figure it out yourself. Take a cab, whatever. So I peel out of the parking lot, like really frustrated. You know how it gets. You have road rage. You're like pounding the steering wheel. All of a sudden, Kevin, for absolutely no reason, jumps in front of my car like he's a flying squirrel in the middle of the parking lot. This is nowhere near the door where he's supposed to be. He just jumps in front of the car. So I slam on the brakes and I just look at him like, what are you doing right now? Why are you doing this in life? And it was probably, I would say I missed killing him by about 4 feet. I mean, there was about 4 feet between my bumper and him. And I wasn't going super fast because I was in a parking lot, but he would have been in the hospital if I had hit him. I mean, it's pretty clear. And so then he kind of just, but here's the funny part though. So he gets into the car, he could not be more sheepish.
He's like so embarrassed that he just did this. He's lost his foot. He knows I'm raging, right? He's trying to be like very passive aggressively. He looks over at me. He's like kind of glancing over to see if I'll like calm down or not. And he's finally just like, okay, well, let's go get my phone now. It's just like, God.
It would have been very suspicious if we had uncovered an email where you said you wanted to become the new editor of Basketball Prospectus or the new book. It would be very suspicious. Well,
how am I going to talk my way out of that? You know, like, there's just like, you know, I have to report it. I'm going to have all this drama with the insurance company and the rental car because I didn't get the Hertz rental car insurance. You know, I just got the cheap stuff. So not only am I going to have, like, one of my friends in traction in the hospital, I'm going to have all these massive legal bills. And it was all his fault because he lost his freaking cell phone 7 hours into a Vegas trip.
Oh, and God, I wish this had become a lawsuit between the two of you and just the recriminations and the, you lost your cell phone, you hit me with a car. It would have been, it would have been some insight into the little blogger world.
Hit yourself with the car. It was unbelievable. It drove me absolutely nuts. But here, the big point is, we got the cell phone back. He actually got his cell phone back. He lost his cell phone in a cab, and it was like 1 to 10,000 odds. I mean, he should have gone straight to, like, you know, whatever casino and bet on Tunisia to win the gold medal, or like played craps and like bet the same number 12 times in a row, because his luck in getting his phone back and not dying also, I mean, that's Vegas, baby. I don't think there's been a better Vegas situation than that.
Okay, so there you have it, Kevin. That's exactly how it unfolded. Why were you doing any of those things? Can you explain that? I mean, that was the thing that was getting me raging the most, is what is your side of the story? Because I'm only seeing it through the red eyes of someone who was just so angry at the moment, so stressed out. What were you thinking?
All right, well, this is good. Part of the reason we needed to do this wingcast was so I had this chance to defend myself, since I was out innocently eating teriyaki when this whole thing went down yesterday, and just came back to find out, oh, Blizzard has threw you under the, Apple has threw you under the bus on Hoops We Climb. So first off, I am obviously an idiot. It was like 10 hours in that I lost my phone in Las Vegas, but it's crazy. Nothing like that has ever happened to me. I almost never lose anything. Last month, two months ago, I left my credit card at a restaurant when I was paying the bill, and that was like the first time that had ever happened. So then this takes place, and I'm like, wait, is there something wrong with me? Like, am I completely losing it? You know, it was so dumb, because the fact that I realized I didn't have it in my pocket as soon as I hit the steps of the hotel, but by that point, it was too late, and, you know, I didn't have any information about the cab I was in. I was totally at the mercy of trying to call the next morning.
Yeah, that was just brutal. Well, so, let's... Full disclosure, how hammered were you when you lost your cell phone? You were just plastered, right?
Well, I wish I was, because then I could be like, oh, you know, I'm such a screw-up. But then I had, like, 3 beers and had stopped drinking several hours earlier, hanging out with the SB Nation crew and Holly McKenzie, among others, Bob Mahoney. So, you know, I was pretty sober by that. It's really not an excuse at all. It's just my own stupidity.
So when every person who's listening to this podcast rushes to the conclusion that this was the first time you left your cat house in 6 months, and, you know, you weren't really prepared for the Vegas experience, and you got hammered off of, like, a 6-foot-tall margarita, and you stumbled around and lost your cell phone, that's not true. None of that happened.
It's not quite true, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely was. I was just sitting there checking Twitter on my phone during this 10-minute cab ride, and I left it on the seat. It's really, really no good explanation for it whatsoever. And, you know, the thing is, I didn't know how rare it was to get your phone back if you lost it in a cab, because obviously that's not something I've ever done before. So it's only kind of in hindsight, after talking to other people, that I realized how lucky the resolution of this story was.
Oh, that's what I was trying to tell you the entire weekend. Now, that makes so much sense that you didn't know that, because the entire weekend I'm like, there's no way you're going to get your phone back. I would have sold that phone. Remember I was telling you that if I had found your phone, I would have sold it on the strip. I would have taken the SIM card out and sold it immediately. What a great friend. Okay, so I'm not so worried, actually, about the phone being lost. I think the centerpiece of the struggle of this story is why you weren't by that hotel door. Why were you jumping in the middle of a freaking parking lot in front of a moving car?
Well, so you said the entrance that we had gone to the day before, which actually was a story in and of itself because of you trying to pick me up from the airport. I don't know if we have time to get into that. But that's part of the context of why I was so sheepish after I got in the car. I already had made you late the USA basketball game the day before, so I thought you might kill me with your car or otherwise.
Okay. Let's back this up real quick. So the previous day I tried to pick him up from the airport, and I completely got – there's only two terminals, Terminal 1 where everyone flies into every single flight, and then Terminal 3, which has some international flights. Obviously there's not a ton of people flying direct from, like, St. Petersburg, Russia to Las Vegas, right? So I was over in Terminal 3, which is where the international flights are, not understanding it whatsoever, not able to find him. This is, a blogger leaving his house for the first time in 6 months, but totally screwing up what hits the real world. So that had happened previously. We almost missed the Team USA game because of that whole fiasco. So we come back the next day with, or not even the next day, like Kevin said, 10 hours later, and he loses his cell phone, and now the next day is spent goose chasing his cell phone down all across the city. So the hotel
this is
door,
a
though,
part of the city.
Yeah, the hotel door, though, I thought that was pretty clear. I don't understand what part, why that was not accurate. I mean, there was the one back door that we had walked through. That's where the car was. You weren't there. Why not?
Well, what happened was the day before we parked in the parking garage and walked over there. So I just saw that route, and I was standing opposite the parking garage, assuming that you were going to drive by at some point, and that that was the place where I had the most visibility of everything that was going on, and there's no way I could miss you. I didn't realize that there was a kind of a side entrance that you could use to get directly to that door, which is where you were. So I'm just sitting there baffled, like, you know, it doesn't get really late, you know, is he not able to pick me up? And I'm thinking that, you know, if we don't connect with each other at this point, there's really no good way to do it. I tried to get Wi-Fi on my computer to see if I could, you know, somehow message you like that. But it made me wonder how anyone ever possibly communicated without cell phones because of the fact that it was so difficult to get the message between the two of us who were like 50 feet apart and both wondering where the other one was.
Oh, that's a great point, man. We are so tied to technology. Okay, so now this is the crucial part. You need to explain your thought process when you went into flying squirrel mode and decided that you just decided, screw it, I don't care if I die here, I'm getting my cell phone today, and if that involves jumping in front of a moving vehicle, I don't care. You know, you're just going to live your life. You know, you only live once.
Again, I finally see you coming out of that area, and it's just like, if you go by me and don't pick me up, I am totally stranded here. I'm going to have to figure out a way to get a cab and go to this place, you know, with some cabbie who's going to be completely skeptical of the whole thing. It just did not seem like a good situation. So my thought process is I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that you stop. No, I want to say for the record, though, that I never believed my life to be in danger.
That's
why maybe the story that I have in my mind differs from the one that you have and have told.
How close do you think that you were from being hit by a moving vehicle?
Not that close. I mean, if it had gone a little longer, if you hadn't noticed me a little longer, and I had actually had to, like, jump into your path instead of just, like, waving my arms wildly back and forth, and you were only going, like, you know, 20 miles an hour. I mean, I think, you know, it could have been a glancing blow and they could have totally survived.
Well, you know, when I turned the car back into Hertz, they could tell by the tire tread that I had slammed my brakes on so I didn't hit a person. They actually thought they worried that I was hitting a deer out in the Arizona wilderness, but it wasn't. They could tell from the tire tread, the marks that the car left, that I had slammed my brakes on and avoided killing someone. So there, evidence.
But truly?
No, that didn't happen, but I'm just trying to make it, you know, I gotta back my story up here because you're undercutting the whole fun part of how I almost killed you. So, okay, so then explain this. So then why is your face, you're standing out there in 110 degree heat for this entire thing. We've left that part of the story out. It's like 105 degrees outside. Literally, it's Vegas. You come into the car, but your face is completely white. Was it because you were afraid? I assumed it was because you were afraid that I almost killed you with the car. Or were you worried I was just going to kill you inside the car? Is that why your face was all white?
Yes. Yes, I really thought that was a possibility. If I said the wrong thing, if I made a joke at that point, normally we had the kind of relationship, as you can tell from the podcast, where we giggle with each other constantly. But at that point, I knew that I had to avoid saying anything to set you off.
Give the listeners an idea for what I look like at that point.
I mean, that bright red, I think, is a fair description. The other thing is that all day you had been so concerned about getting your credential at the Summer League, because, you know, it's a pretty strict show over at the Summer League. They don't let just anyone into the Summer League media section. So you wanted to arrive a half hour early, and because of this half hour we spent there and having to go pick up the cell phone on the wrong side of town, it pretty much guaranteed that you were going to be late. So that's adding to my factor here, though, of fearing repercussions of Ben.
That's true. I was pretty stressed out. Anytime I don't get a confirmation email on anything, I really freak out these days. I expect confirmation emails on everything. So if I don't get one, it's like I'm just going to enter this state of paranoid panic where, like, the world's going to fall apart. Don't have a confirmation email. Everything worked out fine. It wasn't a big deal. Glad you got your cell phone back. It was ridiculous. I am not so thrilled that you tried to downplay how much I almost killed you with a car and made me out to be a homicidal maniac, but I think after selling you out on Hoopsteak Live, you know, it was right to give you a forum to present your side of the story.
But, you know, I love it because I really messed up your weekend. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we had those two stories, and then a third time where I tried to have Ben drop me off on Sunday before the game started and didn't know the exact directions, and we end up on a freeway going the wrong direction. It was certainly an eventful weekend.
That's true, yeah. I tried to take you to Mass, and we ended up almost in New Mexico. It was, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be allowed to drive. Maybe the moral of the story isn't that you should take care of your cell phone better. It should be that I'm not allowed to operate a moving vehicle. Maybe that's the better conclusion. Anyway,
I just throw Bill Barnwell under the bus because he drove me around a bunch this weekend, and thank you very much to the both of you. Really appreciated it. I only had to take one cab ride, which, of course, was the fateful one where I lost my cell phone all weekend. But Bill has lived in Las Vegas for about a year now, and I think I know the directions around the Strip better than he does. So you won't be alone in that regard.
Man, it was a crazy month. Glad it's over. Any thoughts from the actual Summer League, or should we just move on to the Olympics?
Well, I didn't watch the Blazers play almost at all because I scheduled my trip terribly. My flight was taking off to come home right during the middle of their first game, and they ended up playing in the afternoon several times, so I think I only watched one of their games.
Hey, I mean, it was, you know, just the short version, it was a good takeaway. I mean, there was nothing, you know, terribly concerning other than the play and the mentality of Luke Babbitt, but, you know, I'm already over that because I'm watching Victor Claver, and Victor Claver is Euro Babbitt, man. This guy, he's everything that's bad about Babbitt just stretched, like, just to the third power. It just drives me freaking insane. But, no, Babbitt, I thought maybe he had turned a corner at the end of last season, and then to see him kind of go out there and just get picked on defense, to see him, you know, not have great shooting performances over the course of the week, to see him really down on himself, to see him kind of almost like he didn't even want to be there. It's a little concerning, especially because he's playing in front of the new boss. You know, he's got to make a good first impression with Olshay. You know, Olshay doesn't have the same ties to him like all the other, you know, previous regimes did. I was a little worried for Babbitt, but, you know, the rookies look, you know, in their own ways, they all look really good. I think Leonard, you know, he's going to be a little bit of a longer-term project, but, you know, in terms of what Lillard brought, obviously I thought he deserved the MVP honors that he shared with Josh Selby. Thought he showed a lot. I don't know if he showed that everything is going to translate to the NBA level, because that second level of defense in Summer League just isn't there. If you beat your guy, you know, the big men who are coming over to help aren't real shot-blocking threats. They're not guys who are going to be able to, you know, time things well or clog the lane and prevent you from driving. They're just sort of props, and I think he really disposed of all of them pretty easily. And he was able to beat everybody off the dribble, and he didn't have a bunch of, you know, top-notch competition in terms of, you know, positions. I mean, the only big prospect he played against was Austin Rivers, who ended up getting a bone spur surgery right afterwards. They didn't play much of the week. And so I'm not sure he got a great test, but at the same time, the test that he did get, he aced, and you can't really ask for anything more than that. Can't wait to see what he does at training camp. And, of course, there was that Nolan Smith thing, which was just ridiculously terrifying, right in front of the press row. Thankfully, that worked out okay, and he's going to be all right. And that was pretty much the week in terms of Blazers.
You know, I would say in terms of following Lillard's stat line and what I did see, you know, what impressed me was the variety of different ways that he was making plays. It wasn't just getting layups off the dribble at the rim. It was also him making plays as a passer, and, you know, his three-point shooting ability is what I think differentiates him potentially from the obvious Jared Bayless comparison. Is that a fair take?
Oh, he was knocking shots down for sure. It started really slow in the first game, but his shot looked great after that. They were really focusing on two things with him, which was, and Caleb, you know, was saying this after every single game, in terms of offensively, they were trying to get him to do all the progressions through the pick and roll, which is, you know, reading of the team defense, you know, attacking when you're supposed to attack, settling, you know, pulling it back and shooting when you're supposed to do that, moving the ball quickly if they jump you, and finding the open man, you know, in the corner, you know, when that's there, if they're collapsing. And he was doing all those things, like you said, very well. And, you know, he shot the ball fairly well, too. And he seems like he's a good shooter. But, again, you know, it's one of those things where he's not having somebody up in his jersey, you know, really making him work. And he's not you can't show in that, you know, situation, you know, how can you shoot in the third and fourth quarter when you're tired, when somebody's draped all over you. You've got two NBA players guarding you, you know, playing the pick and rolls, you know, real big guys. You know, just some things you can't show in that situation. And you can't hold that against him. But, you know, in terms of his overall week, I think I gave him an A, and I think he deserved it.
Yeah, you can't fault him for not showing things that he didn't have the opportunity to show against that level of competition.
Exactly. Well, let's talk quickly about the Olympics. And, you know, we've already hit all the important things, how famous we are in the Portland Mercury. I almost killed you, but we should probably talk some real basketball. So let's get into some Olympics discussion. You know, Blazers have three players, Nicholas Batum, Joel Freeland, and Victor Corver, who I already mentioned how much he's driving me nuts so far. You know, everybody pretty much knows what to expect from Nicholas at this point. He started really slow against USA, and there was a little bit of panic there from some quarters. You know, it seemed what Dave wrote in terms of, you know, level head, he's going to bounce back. I mean, that seemed really the obvious take on his game against USA. I mean, they weren't ready for that game. They got completely, you know, handled. And you know, he was going against Kobe on one end and Durant and LeBron on the other end. And he looked a little bit afraid of LeBron. I don't want to go too hard on him, but he looked a little bit timid. But you knew he was going to play better throughout the rest of the Olympics than he has so far. He's put together two really good games against Argentina and the other game they just played. I'm blanking on who they played. Lithuania, I think. So, you know, I think he's right where you expect him to be. He can play better, but he's playing very well. And, you know, you move forward, you know, with that evaluation, you know, pretty comfortably.
Yeah, I think this is the first time that ever a player's NBA contract has been evaluated. It's a veteran NBA player. I mean, there's lots of guys who are new to the league who get evaluated by how they play in international competition, which I think is to be expected with guys like Freeland and Clavier, since this is the first time we're really getting an extended look at them. But it's so weird to see that, like, scrutinizing every game with Batum, who, you know, we know what Batum is. I mean, I think we... You know, that there's a hope that he's going to be a little something more than he has been in the NBA next year, you know, as he gets the opportunity to be the Blazers' second best player potentially all season long. But freaking out over one game with France is probably an overreaction at this point, especially because France now at this point is one of the surprises of the tournament. They're, you know, looking like a lock to finish second in Group A with their two easiest games coming up.
Yeah, no, that game against Argentina was very impressive. I think, you know, Argentina's pretty good, and going against Manu, I mean, Manu's ridiculous in international play. I think France just has more depth of talent, and that's really showing to be a separator, I think, so far in this tournament, and they just go so much deeper to their bench. You got teams like Argentina and Great Britain who are basically like two-man teams, you know, and if one guy, you know, one of their other players gets injured, you know, one of their important starters, the drop-off from that first unit to the second unit is huge, and, you know, France has a lot of different ways they can beat you. If Tony Parker's stepping up, all of a sudden, you know, he makes life so much easier for everybody else, which he did against Lithuania. And they looked pretty good in that game against Lithuania, I thought. You know, Boris Diaw was big as well, but Boris Diaw's always big. So let's talk about the more intriguing guy, the guy who's got me excited. He's got me writing 3,000-word recaps after every single one of those games. That's Joel Freeland from Great Britain. I'll be honest, I didn't watch a ton of Joel Freeland before this Olympics or, you know, maybe some of the recent European tournaments, just because I never really thought he was going to come over to the NBA. I thought it was one of these typical Blazers things. We draft a guy 15 years ago. They eventually trade his rights, you know, to someone in some other package, and you never hear from him. But finally, after all these years, the exodus is going to be complete. He's coming to Portland. He's signed his contract. He's on the books. He's going to be there in training camp. And I think he's having a very impressive Olympics. Am I crazy? And I'm not trying to say this in a hype way, but I'm saying it, you know, like, I love basketball. I love watching guys play hard, play basketball the right way, and go all out. And that's what Joel Freeland's all about. And he's doing it on a big stage against really quality competition.
I don't think you're crazy at all. It's interesting talking about Summer League. The last time I was in Summer League was 5 years ago in 2007 when I went down working for the Sonics. And that was the only other time I'd really seen Joel Freeland when he played in that Summer League for the Blazers and then flew up to Seattle on my same flight at a random celebrity sighting. What's impressed me about Freeland in the Olympics is how rugged he is, just kind of dealing with these bigger post players for other teams. Is Great Britain's center, alongside Pos Mensah-Bonsu, and then showing the ability to step out and make the international three at times, I think, is the other thing that's really impressed me.
Yeah, so let's break down his skills real quick and say what's going to translate, what's not going to translate, what's going to be helpful, what's not going to be helpful. When I look at the helpful skills, number one by far is that his motor, he has an elite motor. He expends more energy in one of these games than every single other player on the floor. The only person who's going as hard as him is Luol Deng, and I think Deng's playing sort of with a chip on his shoulder because of everything that's been going on in Chicago about his injury, and he's got to be the face of the franchise, you know, for the London Olympics. I mean, Deng's going hard, but I think Freeland may be going harder than every single other player in every single game that he's played so far, all three of the games.
Yeah, you know, I think that's fair to say, and it really helps him in terms of on the glass and being a problem there.
So, okay, so we're going to say his motor translates. His lack of size, unfortunately, I think, you know, his lack of height and length, and then he doesn't have the leaping ability to compensate for it, that's going to translate too. I mean, you saw Mark scoring over him. You saw Calderon getting into the key and putting up pretty easy shots over the top of him. Powell scored over the top of him. In the previous game, Splitter scored over the top of him, and that's going to be an issue. That's really ultimately what's going to keep him from being a major starting quality player in the NBA. I think that's fair to say.
Especially, you know, if LaMarcus Aldridge doesn't want to play that five position, which means that, you know, for Freeland to be on the court for extended minutes, he's going to have to be battling those guys. And I think that looking at the way the Blazers roster sets up for next season, I think, you know, there's a decent chance that Freeland still ends up starting it in the middle next Aldridge, and that will be an issue.
Yeah, it's going to be an issue. So in terms of his offensive game, he's got the mid-range. Pretty solid, not knockdown, not Aldridge knockdown, but he's got a mid-range game. Like you said, he can step it out to the international three. I'm not sure he's the guy, though. I mean, obviously compared to how he's shooting in Great Britain where they just need him to shoot every single shot, I'm not sure he's going to be able to show off all that range on a regular basis in the NBA because so few guys do it. I mean, outside of Kevin Love and Andrew Bynum when he's trying to get his coach fired, I mean, how many of these traditional four or five are out there shooting. And are the Blazers going to be, you know, freewheeling enough to allow him to have that kind of flexibility and freedom? I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to visualize his range being a true asset for this team. Am I wrong there?
Well, I disagree with you there because, I mean, I think it has to be playing with LaMarcus Aldridge, you know, how much you want Aldridge in the post. So I think it's more like what we saw from Marcus Camby last year where he, you know, lived at the elbow and tried to play the high-low games. So, you know, to the extent that Freeland can work on that kind of chemistry with Aldridge, that, you know, Camby was very good at throwing the lob, is probably as good as any center in the league. So he's not, you know, I don't expect Freeland to be there, but I think he's probably a better shooter from 15 to 17 feet than Camby.
Yeah, no, I agree there. No question about it. I think he can show you that mid-range game. Everything past that's where I start to get worried. And I also worry, you know, at this point of his career when he's been so used to that 1 3-point line, switching to the NBA 3-point line, there's a big difference. I mean, look, that shorter 3-point line makes Carmelo Anthony look like a good basketball player. And that's how big of a difference there is between the 3-point lines. So if you're going the other way after spending, you know, your entire career up to the age of, what, 25, 26, at the shorter one, gets me a little nervous.
Yeah, and I think it's probably more of an issue for big guys that aren't shooting from, you know, a couple feet beyond the three-point line almost ever than it is for a guard who maybe is taking those deeper shots. So, you know, someone like Alexei Shved coming over here, I think it's probably less of an issue for him than it is for Freeland. So, yeah, I agree that I think he's a long two-shooter in the NBA, not a three-shooter at this point at least.
Very good. So in terms of, you know, he hasn't shown a ton passing, but he has nobody to pass the ball to, so that's a little bit tricky. He likes to get out in transition if he possibly can. You know, I mean, he is an active runner in terms of making rim runs or filling lanes. I mean, he does it like not like a three, but you know, he's running hard, and he can certainly, if they decide to push the tempo, he's going to be right there ready to do it. You know, some of his footwork and technical skills I thought are pretty solid. You know, in terms of being able to seal guys, I wonder though against when he's playing against all NBA competition if he's going to have as much success or if he's going to look a little bit physically overmatched. But I think, you know, he's potential, you know, what's his best case scenario to you when he comes over for his rookie year? Is he a spot starter, or is he a normal minute starter, where you're maybe putting him at the, you know, you're calling him a five, but him and Aldridge kind of interchange, or you're going to bring him off the bench, or what do you see his role?
I think he's probably going to end up playing around 25 minutes a game. You know, is my guess. I think that's what I projected him for. Shaney, you know, you've got, you know, LaMarcus somewhere in between 35 and 40 minutes a game, but that's still leaving you with, you know, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 minutes to fill between him and J.J. Hickson and Myers Leonard. And, you know, as exciting as Hickson's play was at the end of last season, I think that finishing is the only area he has an advantage over Freeland, and that in terms of rebounding and defense in particular, that Freeland's advantages are probably going to make him the starter next to Aldridge.
I think that makes sense. I like him better than Hickson by a lot. At least what he's shown so far on this stage. Again, you know, once we're comparing apples to apples, it'll be a little bit easier, but I think he's been great. Any other thoughts on the Olympics or summer thoughts or, oh, I know what you're going to want to do. Plug the book.
How did you know? Hey, yeah, I actually just yesterday started the first set of team essay and player capsules for the book. I'm working on the Brooklyn Nets, just about finished on them, and 14 more to go over the course of the next month or so, and we hope to have it out, I would say, right at the start of training camp.
Excellent. So just give me a quick, you know, winners, losers of the offseason, just, you know, one sentence summaries. Who did you like in terms of what they did, and who didn't you like? And then, you know, is there going to be any major changes to the book, or is it going to be a similar, you know, very deep format that we've come to know and love from previous years?
You know, pretty similar format. I would say the only change is that, you know, this year it'll be a little bit cleaner and better proofread than it was with last year's furious sprint to get the book out before the training camp. As far as the off season, I would say that the Lakers, the Timberwolves, I think are big winners. I don't think anyone should sleep on them with the guys that they've added, and more importantly, possibly the guys that they've lost on the wing. Their improvements there are massive. If Ricky Rubio is anywhere near healthy, I think that they're a lock for the playoffs going into the season. And then I would say Atlanta, with the cleared cap space and still have a competitive team for next year. I think that second part has been forgotten by people who are, you know, overstating the guys they've lost and underrating the guys that they added. Losers of the offseason, I mean, a lot of people, it's weird because there's this short-term, long-term issue. I think both the Knicks and the Nets have improved for the next season. The Nets, obviously, dramatically so, but yet they're kind of in a worse position going forward. So I don't know how you evaluate that. And then, obviously, you know, I think I agree with everyone that Chicago is just going to be a shell of itself next season while waiting for Derrick Rose to get healthy.
So what do you think about Miami? You like Miami summer?
I did. I mean, I didn't, you know, I think Ray Allen's going to be a perfect fit there. I think, you know, Rashard Lewis, for what he cost and for the role he's going to have to play, is, you know, if he's your 12th man, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think they are almost one of the biggest winners of anybody, but I guess we'll see how it plays out. They got to get healthy. They got to get Wade healthy and Bosh healthy before they can call it a totally great summer. All right, Kevin, I can't wait for Basketball Perspectives 2012-2013. People are going to be able to find it on your website, Amazon.com. We'll probably do a giveaway on BE. Does that sound good?
Yeah, hopefully this year I won't forget and leave the box of books that they send to me outside for like 6 months.
All the homeless people in South Seattle are huge basketball nerds now, aren't they?
Yeah. We've converted the whole neighborhood.
I had to give it away at a soup kitchen because you had 65 extra copies of your book. All right, Kevin, it's been well. I'm glad that we could sporadically update this great podcast. I look forward to talking to you again soon. Have a good summer.
Yeah, hopefully it's not another 6 months next time.
Yeah, okay, we'll try. We say that every time, and we never do. Take care.
No.
CEO's heard, now here come Big K. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup, for you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clack game. For that fame, bro, entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment, killer.